Professor Heichel, you said something up on that panel session today that rarely, if ever, is heard in the Australian debate. This is such a live issue in Australia, where there are suspected to be about 200 Australians fighting in Iraq and Syria for ISIS and affiliated groups.
Yeah.
And there is a very natural and a very deep concern at the public level and at the political level about what happens when these fighters come back. What sort of threat will they pose to Australian society?
Yeah.
But you put a slightly contrarian view, which, as I said, I haven't heard before in the Australian debate. Tell us what you think about this theory.
Yeah, I mean, the theory about blowback, about people sort of going to battlefields and then getting radicalized and coming back with their battle experience and then wanting to engage in violence back home, is one that held true for some of Al-Qaeda's recruits from the 80s and 90s. I think this is a qualitatively different phenomenon in the Islamic State. Most of the people who are going there are actually burning their passports and cutting their links with their home countries. They're very likely, and wanting to die, and very likely will die in Iraq or Syria. So I think we should actually encourage them to do so. I mean, to go and die. If they do come back, firstly, they'll have to get a passport somehow. So we'll know who they are if we don't already know who they are. The other dimension of this phenomenon is that if you prevent them from going, then you basically have lone wolf attackers who are constantly lurking in your society. And you have to expend a considerable amount of, a lot of resources just keeping track of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, my view, which as you described is contrarian, and it is to actually encourage them to go and not ever come back, which is what they want anyway.
Now, this idea that these recruits are going over there not to come back, but to die, essentially.
Right.
They want to kill and they want to die.
Right.
Is there enough data at the moment for you to base that conclusion on solid research, or this is a supposition you're working on?
No, I mean, it's based on their own propaganda, the videos that they produce where they burn their passports and they reject the nation state as a construct, they reject their identity, and that we have no... At least I know of no single incident that has taken place where someone has gone and come back and actually committed an act of terrorism back home. The Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris was inspired largely by Al-Qaeda, and allegedly, although I'm not convinced that's the case, but largely motivated by Al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Al-Qaeda that actually is very much encouraging the lone wolf attack in the West. The Islamic State is not saying engage in lone wolf attacks. It's saying come here and fight here with us.
Yep.
And people should be allowed to go.
Now, the other thing I heard on this session this afternoon was, I thought a slightly difficult, contrary thread of views about why these people go to fight in Iraq and Syria. One was this idea that some of your fellow panelists put about a longing for adventure, young people looking who are disenfranchised, looking for adventure and perhaps looking to find a wife. The other view was that these people are going there because they're attracted to the idea of living in a caliphate that represents Islam in its purest form. Seems to me both of those things can't be true.
Well, actually, they're not mutually exclusive, right? You can actually go and want to live the life of a good Muslim under the caliph and also have adventure and also have women and also fight. So this is the beauty of the Islamic State in terms of its propaganda appeal to so many people, is that you can kind of, you can combine the you know, the virtuous religious life with a meaningful life that is exciting and that gives you lots of rewards, at least in theory, in their fantasy, in the fantasy world that they construct. So I think they're not mutually exclusive in terms of the appeal that they present to outsiders.
Now, you talked today about ISIS taking on many of the characteristics of a state.
Right.
Not perhaps a purely territorial state. But in any case, many of those characteristics.
I mean, not a territorially bounded state.
Right.
Yeah, but they definitely are a territorial state.
Yes. I just wonder, though, about the sustainability of the ISIS model of statehood. And doesn't I mean, isn't traditionally the strength of terrorist groups is that they aren't territorially, they don't have territory, they don't have large state structures which can easily be attacked.
That's right.
So I just wonder about the sustainability of the model that ISIS has developed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think in the world that we live in it's sustainable, because the world will not tolerate an aggressive, Islamic State that is constantly engaged in offensive war against neighboring states. So, you know, if ISIS were to bump up against Turkey, they would get hammered by the Turks, and they deliberately don't attack Turkey for that reason. Now, they're taking advantage of the chaos in Syria and Iraq to create this state. And they can exist in a situation of chaos. As an Australian, you probably would appreciate the fact that, you know, the areas they control were a bit like Mad Max land until they arrived, and they brought some degree of stability and control to these territories. But they can only kind of function in what is effectively Mad Max territory, and then establish themselves.
One of your fellow panelists said today that the very bloody killings that ISIS engages in, the beheadings and so on, setting the Jordanian pilot alight, that this is all intended to outrage and outrage Western audiences, and is essentially an attempt to goad Western and foreign military forces, foreign countries, into overreacting. Do you agree with that? Is that?
Yes. They have a kind of apocalyptic vision in their theology that wants to attract the Westerners into the fight, because they believe that that's what leads to Armageddon and the end end times. But I don't think that's why they do it. I think they do it for perhaps three reasons. One is that they want to constantly be in the news. So that the kind of outrageous acts keeps them in the news, gives them publicity. The publicity then helps them with recruits, because they posture, they present themselves as, you know, the only true Muslims who are fulfilling, you know, the edicts of Islam in a literal and punctilious fashion. So it helps with recruitment and propaganda. It also, lastly, helps with demoralizing the enemy, which is part of the strategy that they deliberately are pursuing, which is that if you terror is a strategy for winning war for them. So demoralizing your enemy, terrifying your enemy is part of the war.
And so the destruction of antiquities, for instance, that was essentially a media strategy?
It is that, and it's also this posturing that they are doing, which is to say, we are the true Muslims destroy idols, we're destroying idols. So it's all about the production of Islamic authenticity as they describe it. You know, pure Islam is an Islam that destroys antiquities and idols, and it has good propaganda value because it shows them as being really true to the original teachings as they believe them to be. And then finally, it keeps you in the news, right? So it serves a number of purposes.
Professor Huckel, thanks for your time.
Thank you.